time now for the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
I guess that's me.
Last time I checked.
Yeah.
But you are always evolving.
That's true. I've changed many times since I woke up this morning, Alice once said. Hey, speaking of Alice, hi, Mrs. Future.
Hi, sweetie. Down the rabbit hole we go. Welcome to Future Tuesday.
Oh, we got some good rabbit holes today, I tell you. And we got Bobby on the line in San Francisco. Hey, Bobby.
Yes, I'm ready for the adventure.
Yeah. Oh, right, good. Yeah, you just threw us a new rabbit hole just before I went on the air here, as a matter of fact.
Should we jump right down it?
Should we start there? It depends on how long it takes. I mean, I do like space news, but we can do a little bit of reports that are breaking news.
Yeah, because some of your space news goes all the way back to the origin of space. That's definitely looking backwards.
Or space itself.
So we should maybe start in at least the present before we go totally back.
Okay. Well, yeah, Bobby, I noticed that you posted a video of one of our favorite people, Dr. Campbell, in England, talking about how Japan has approved ivermectin for treatment of COVID-19.
It's not approval. What they do is they allow the usage of ivermectin because, it was discovered there in Japan. And the guy, Omuro, got the Nobel Prize in 2015 for it. So it is approved, but it's allowed.
Sanctioned by the medical establishment.
Well, in the CDC here, there are treatments that are authorized but not approved. And nothing is approved until it's been all the way through clinical trials and there's been some honest reporting of the potential risks, which hasn't happened for this current round of treatments here in the U.S. anyway.
Yeah.
That's authorized versus approved.
Yes.
So what's the outcome? They've started applying it in, I just had a chance to look at it for 30 seconds before we went on the air, but from what I can see, they started using it in August?
August the 13th. Uh-huh. And so what happened was there was a steep rise right after the Olympics in Tokyo. So the medical minister of Tokyo suggested everybody take ivermectin on August 13th. And then the spike continued for a couple days. And now this spike has dropped down to zero. It's crazy.
Really?
It's crazy. It's a miracle. Wow. That's what it is. It's a miracle.
Oh. And that's the big change that they did, the use of ivermectin.
Well, they attribute that could be one of it. There's other ideas out there that, maybe the Delta variant did self-extinction by... There was an error in the protein, this NSP14 protein that does error correcting. Mm. And somehow the variant that's there in Japan mutated, and it mutated to the point where it just self-destructed.
Mutated and died.
Yeah. And so that's one theory. Oh. And then the other theory is in Japan and Asian populations, they have this APOBEC3A gene that produces a protein that affects, again, this NSP14 protein that's in the COVID virus. And again, that could be another factor. But
ivermectin is another factor that looks...
Yeah, and the health minister believes it's ivermectin. But there's these other people that believe it could be the genes of the Japanese.
Emphasize about this kind of information is this is real medical information because, as many doctors we know have stated, medicine is an art more than a science. When you have individuals with individual health conditions and health histories, the idea of prescribing the same exact thing to everyone, irregardless of their condition, is not medicine.
Yeah, we're going to individualized medicine. It's obvious that's the future.
Yeah. So art and science is where you use your unique perception of what is important to make clear what is the appropriate understanding. So anyway, that's, yeah. I'm just saying, good on you, Bobby, for bringing us a real medical article showing how people can agree to disagree and have different theories and yet be very proud of their successful results.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I it made my day.
Yeah, that's great. That's good to start off on a high note here. I did take mine this morning, so.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to take mine tomorrow. Before I go for Thanksgiving.
So. Oh, before they go to the big party. Yeah.
Well, it will be the second one this week because I always take mine on Sunday or, you know, sometimes Saturday. But
yeah. Uh-huh. So you take it once a week and then extra if you're going to a gathering?
Yes. That's what I
do. Smart. That's the way to do it. Yeah. So how do you think it works? Like, what do you think for you, your use of it? How is that affecting your health? Like, why is it working? In 30 seconds or left before we go to the break.
It works on so many different aspects of different viruses. It works on not just on the replication that, you know, a lot of these new approved treatments are going to come out, but it works on different mechanisms on the virus. So I don't know. I actually feel better after I take it. You know, it's kind of...
Well, there you go.
I can't explain it.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. One of my brothers who has done the booster shot even says he feels better after the booster shot.
Oh, yeah. He said he felt like a superhuman. Yeah. At least for the first month. And then,
individualistic.
Not so much.
Yeah, not so much. Like that. Oh, man. Oh, yes. Thanks to Michael in Boulder Creek, who sent us this piece that's only going to be up for about 30 hours before it's taken down by...
One of the disinfo dozen.
Yeah, one of the disinfo dozen.
Very famous doctor.
Joseph Merkula did a piece on how COVID-19 jab benefits are exaggerated. Jab benefits are exaggerated. And he explains how that works.
Are you going to go over that after the break?
No. I'm going to go into a lot of other things. But I'm saying if you want to know more about that, that's at drfutureshow.com/links for 30 hours. Then it goes away.
There you go. If you want to know, see you after the show. Here we go.
All right. Okay, welcome back to the show. Yes, on our website, we have a couple other articles related to the whole COVID story, including a piece from our friend Mihai from the National Institute of Health, which is about how COVID-19 increases are unrelated to levels of vaccination across 68 countries and 2,947 counties in the United States.
The fact that COVID is on the rise has nothing to do with vaccination?
Well, it's not slowing it down.
Oh, vaccination isn't slowing it down?
No.
Okay.
Anyway, this is NIH data, a fresh study that looks at that in great detail. Mm-hmm. Should be interested in that topic. Mm. Okay, so you probably saw that too, right, Bobby?
Yeah, I just went over that. And I've seen other articles on YouTube saying the same thing, that in some cases, like in England, there is some data in England showing that the people that are vaccinated between 10 and 65 years of age, that they almost doubled their susceptibility to the COVID virus. In fact, they had almost doubled their chances of getting COVID after they were vaccinated.
Oh, geez. So it suggests that somehow your immune system is weakened a little bit.
Yeah, but it's based on age group, you know, so it's between 10 and 65 years of age that occurs. Well, obviously,
that's a pretty wide range. 10 to 65. Wow.
And so there was an increase in catching COVID, almost twice the percentage rate. Yeah. So that was very interesting also.
Yeah. Suggesting that the immune system might be less functional in some levels.
The idea is that your innate immune system, instead of the adaptive, is actually suppressed when you get a vaccine. And so it's like in a war, when you send out the Marines first, and that's your innate immune system, you know, that,
right.
You know, and they have killer T cells and go after that. But those guys are actually called back, and then they bring in the sharpshooters, which are the vaccines, and they do a very targeted focus and do the killing that way.
Right.
So that's the idea that's happening when you're vaccinated. Maybe your innate immune system is suppressed and can't really fight it correctly.
Yes, we're about to be introduced to the pills too, the Pfizer pill and the molnupiravir from Merck.
And, right, yeah.
And that's going to affect the equation. Some consider these pills to be game changers.
Yes, we should bring on all the tools we have to fight this virus any way we can. But I think if you just look at this video about the Japanese miracle, I think there's things that cost less and much more widely available that
that's,
you might consider
gotcha.
Instead.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'll put that in our links page since that just came in at 201. I might
yes.
Thank you, Bobby.
Sorry for the delay.
It's all right. It's kind of interesting. We had some interesting calls today. Just before we were on the air, we got a call from a TV producer in Buffalo, New York, who was really grateful for our show a couple weeks ago with Dr. Matt Vassetti and his analysis of the VAERS database.
I was too, yeah.
That was, they were rare. She says that so much of media is in lockstep with the official narrative, that it's refreshing to hear some other points of view. And that's really what reality is about. Scientists like to argue with each other. They like to debate and question things. They don't walk in lockstep. That's not their nature as a general rule. So she was very pleased to see our piece on that. And hopefully we'll see more articles on it. It sounds like Dr. Campbell is really starting to step out. He used to be quite conservative in his
analysis. He was definitely mainstream. And then since he had millions of followers, they started sending him alternate information, and he's kind of made a turn. And he's reporting things that other people don't report on recently. You could see a change in his perception of this virus.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, those who want to know more, go to YouTube and search for Dr.
John Mercola.
He's a PhD medical lecturer.
And he's been doing a piece on the virus issue practically every day.
A couple times a day.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. He's getting a lot of information. Also, there's a piece on the new pills that Wired did. I thought that was a fairly comprehensive piece, and I put that up on our website as well. That's the two game-changing pills
Yeah. I think you should look at how they work. Take a deep dive before you take them, because they can do some things that you might not want down the road.
Right. Like I've heard the molnupiravir actually interferes with the replication of the virus, but does it interfere with the replication of other cells besides viruses or not other organisms?
Yeah. It is a mutagen. And so what it does, it replaces two out of the four nucleotides that are the building blocks of your DNA.
Yeah.
And so if it affects this virus in that way, can it affect the other healthy cells in the same way too? That's a big question. Mm.
On a related topic, I found it fascinating that there was an article in New Atlas this week about how the mRNA technique that's being used in the vaccines is starting to be used in other vaccines now. There's a new mRNA anti-tick vaccine that's being developed that may protect us from more than just Lyme's disease. That's the promise of the mRNA-based medicine, is that you can change the code and have your cellular machinery create something else besides just the spike protein for the virus. Something else can be made. And in this case, they're attempting to create a vaccine designed to resist tick bites. And it's worked very well with guinea pigs so far, resulting in ticks dislodging before they can transmit any pathogenic disease. They take one bite of somebody who has an immune system that's ready for them and they leave. However, it doesn't work on mice yet. It only works on guinea pigs.
I wonder why they use the knowledge that they have about getting the DNA to produce something to produce a toxin. Why don't they just go directly to getting the DNA to produce the antibodies or the T cells or the things that the body likes to make to be healthy? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to produce something? Why do we have to turn our healthy mechanism into something that's producing a toxin?
That's the way the mRNA works with COVID is it produces the spike protein, the full-length spike protein, and it turns out that in itself is a toxin. So that's the interesting thing. I don't know if you saw last...
I think the mindset is just... There's something wrong with the mindset that says that we need to poison ourselves to heal ourselves.
Well, the idea is that you want your immune system to have essentially a picture, or at least a sense of what it needs to fight against. It has a library of things. So when you present it with...
Well, that's old vaccine.
Same with the spike. That's why they call it a vaccine, because it identifies the spike as something.
Turning your DNA machinery, which is your builder of proteins, into something that's building a toxin is a new way of approaching vaccination. It's not injecting you with a pox that gives you an imprint to respond to in a small, non-dangerous dose. That's the whole argument for vaccines. This actually gives you a toxin in the form of instructions to your DNA to manufacture the toxin.
The spike.
Yeah. It's never been done before in humans. So that's
the point that the old way of doing it, you knew how much toxin you were injecting. You knew where you were putting it, and you knew how to keep it in check. And the new way of doing it, you can make all kinds of arguments that maybe you do know those things, but in fact, you don't, because you don't know where the mRNA is being stimulated throughout the body. You don't know how much mRNA is actually being created by the DNA.
So it's a big question mark, and why do that?
And it's manufacturing toxins rather than injecting them.
It turns out to be a toxin. I don't think they manufactured it as a toxin intentionally.
It's less
toxic than the virus itself because it's smaller, and that therefore we can rest assured it's not dangerous. But
it's not a big deal for immune system to deal with.
All of that thinking is potentially flawed and is certainly untested.
Well, certainly for some people.
That's why it's all experimental use authorization, and it's very suspicious that they're squelching the data of the people who are harmed. The Senate committee looking at Matty DeGarry, who was in the Pfizer children's trial, who's permanently disabled, and that information is absolutely squelched in the media, even though it was the subject of a Senate hearing.
Yeah, well, that's the lockstep media. That's what we were talking about earlier. That is a problem for sure. And to get the real facts is that I was just talking to Gary about that. How do we get facts? How do we get the real facts? And what's facts in these situations? And hopefully we will. We're trying to figure that out. Any other suggestions on how we might get through this?
Yeah, change your Google search from Google to DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuckGo. All right. DuckDuckGo searches. Here we come. Thanks.
Keep your heart open. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
Okay, welcome back to the show. Okay, so that was our COVID report for this week. We have it at drfutureshow.com/links. You can see all the stories we've been talking about there.
On all sides of the aisle.
Yes, and since we have a guest in the next hour, I'd like to cover a couple interesting space news pieces.
Okay, Dr. Future.
Yeah.
Let's go to space. Sure, a lot more air in the room up there.
There's a lot more room. I'll give it that. Sadly, the James Webb Telescope has been delayed again.
Well, as I recall, they predicted that it was going to be delayed. There were all kinds of reasons, maybe related to the COVID or the lockdown or whatever. But, you know, all this year when they've been saying James Webb is going up in November, they've been saying, unless it gets delayed. So
it's funny because it's been delayed so many times that you almost expect it at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But it is going to be the coolest telescope ever
That's right. Be up there. The longer it's worth an extra you wait, month. The better it gets. Yeah.
This latest one is called A Processing Anomaly Has Caused an Unexpected Vibration to Course Through the Entire Telescope Just Weeks Before Launch.
Oh, no. You cannot have an unexpected vibration in a telescope. That's terrible.
Yes. And the investigation is underway now to see if this vibration caused any damage.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully not.
Wow.
Yeah.
Something like that, right?
This is a $10 billion instrument, folks.
That's right. And when you're looking at something that's 32 billion light years away, a little hum can be the difference between thinking that it's 13 billion years away from you or 32. That's a big mistake.
Huge. So the launch was supposed to happen on December 18th, but it's not going to happen. They think maybe, if we're lucky, the 22nd.
You feeling lucky?
And it's currently in preparation at the spaceport in Kourou, French Guiana, where Ariane Space is preparing to launch the instrument. I had to figure that out. I guess James Webb must be an international telescope, not just NASA.
It's so much bigger than Hubble, as far as the number of mirrors that make it up. And
yeah.
And the infrared detectors on it are just amazing. So it's like 10 times better.
Yeah, it makes sense. 10 times better since 1990 when we launched Hubble. Good to have something to take its place. And I'm excited. I hope it actually gets up and we don't have any more disasters. Also, NASA is planning an asteroid slamming mission.
What? What is an asteroid slam? I've heard of a poetry slam.
So is this like the Chinese and the Russians blowing up their own satellites?
It could be.
But
sounds like
blowing.
It, doesn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't.
No, the asteroid, the DART project, is all about us being able to deflect an asteroid into another trajectory so it doesn't hit the Earth. In other words, if you see something barreling down on us, you want to go up there and like push it a little bit out of the way.
And they're doing that with an ion drive.
Like, that's right. That's the exciting.
How powerful is an ion drive?
Very, not very. Very, not very.
I mean, an ion is very small, right?
It's a very underpowered.
Put, 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 put. It's sort of like trying to move it with a flashlight, right? Yeah,
practically. But you see, that's the value of vast distances and years. That we have in space travel.
Sure. A little goes a long way.
That's right. You push for a long period of time, and you can change it enough to save your butts.
So what's their plan here? Okay, they've got the DART. DART is their asteroid slamming mission, right?
That's right. That's right. The Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART for short.
Mm-hmm.
It will launch from Vandenberg on a SpaceX Falcon 9 Wednesday, that's tomorrow, at 1:28 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So that's actually November 23rd at 10:28 our time. So if you have a view of Vandenberg due south of here, check it out.
For the launch?
10:28.
And then what does it say about the asteroid they're going to go after?
They're going to crash into the smaller asteroid of a pair called Didymos, or Dimorphos.
Oh, so they're not really going to redirect the asteroid with the ion drive. They're just going to use the ion drive to get there and then crash into it.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah. Now, I know what you're saying before about pushing it slow. But, you know, for certain very, very distant asteroids, it's not a bad idea. It could save a lot of energy, and you'd be able to use the spacecraft to change the course of something else. It would be like a tugboat, almost. Tugs pushing things.
What's going to be tugged?
And well, not tugged in the sense of pulling it, but in the sense of directing the trajectory of a larger object.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah, tugging.
Instead of tugging it, though, you're going to push
pushing
it.
Pushing it, right.
Right.
You know, tugging.
Nudge. It's a nudge boat.
The tugging's an idea that maybe should be tried as well.
Sure.
You should tug asteroids.
Well, it's all about that fuel, getting the fuel up there. Right?
Yeah, being able to do it fuel effectively, because it takes energy to get rocket propellant and stuff like that up there.
Uh-huh.
That's where the ion
sounds like the way they're going to create the force is literally just through pure momentum. They're just going to use the ion drive to go faster, 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 like the little train that could, you know.
I think I can. I think I can. I think I can.
Put, 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 and keep steering towards that asteroid that we think someday might get close enough to Earth that it's a threat. And then once we get there, just tap it so that it misses the Earth by a little bit. That's the DART mission. We need to hit it in the middle of the target.
Yeah. And it's a very delicate approach, as opposed to, say, getting a big, giant tanker ship there that's just like solid metal and just pushes things out of the way, like an icebreaker.
Right, yeah. Once the big league gets out to space, then there'll be a lot more sort of giant crashes.
Or
going
the
on.
Fishermen with their nets, where you throw a big net over the asteroid and just pull it. That's where the tug comes in real handy.
Where did we see that? That was in The Expanse?
Expanse?
In The Expanse,
they
had
did that.
Asteroid
yeah.
miners yeah. that were throwing nets on asteroids.
That's right. The asteroid miners were a whole part of humanity known as the Belters. And they had a whole culture of their own.
Right. Yeah, it was a big free-for-all. Once you got out in space, nobody could enforce any laws anyway, but you had to survive. So
they were good at that.
Yeah.
They were real good at that.
All right. Do you want to say hi to Steve from Pacific Grove?
Yeah, let's talk to Steve.
All right. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve.
I love you guys. Aww. You know, I was thinking of when you're talking about all the planets, could you help out a pool player?
With my ion putt-putt pool stick?
No, you're talking about all this. All the ways you make the grade and this, that, and the other thing. Your planetary stuff sounds a lot like me playing bad pool, especially when I'm losing.
Yeah. There you go.
This is a metaphor for you, huh? Well, understanding the solar system is kind of like a good pool game.
That's true.
At least in terms of the history of it.
It's definitely much harder to call the pocket.
And what is a pocket on the solar system level? Yeah.
Well, then, you know, that's what I was wondering, when you get the English on stuff, that's what I was thinking about, when you get all the special spins on your ball, you know, the guys that are really good at pool. Mm-hmm.
You're right. Yes, the DART people at NASA should really talk to pool players who are good so that they know just how to hit that asteroid to move it right.
I love that. Yeah. I love that you brought that up. What a good analogy.
English, very important. A speed.
And maybe a free beer.
Oh, now we're talking about motivation. Yeah, that might work even better.
How about collateral effects, like other balls that were hit that you hadn't anticipated?
Oh, that's right. Between here and the asteroid you're aiming for, there's all kinds of invisible debris in space that we just won't know about until we cross.
Yeah, NASA did successfully move the asteroid, but it's on course to hit another asteroid, which will hit another one. And
it goes all the way back to... For all kung fu with all Quiet Chain saying,
yeah,
the pebble
it does.
Was in the pebble.
Say it again. What was in the pebble? Pebble?
Yeah, it goes back to kung fu.
The pebble was in the pebble. You remember Quiet Chain?
Sure.
I loved him.
One of my he'd always be hanging out on top of the jail cell and get rid of the dim-witted white rednecks that are picking on him.
And
he'd always kick their butts.
That's right. Yeah, he was...
Grasshopper.
Yes, Grasshopper. Yeah, of course. He was... great show.
Yes,
I never saw him play pool, though. He probably would have been good at it.
He played a psychic pool. When he'd always be sitting there, and he'd be playing his flute by the side of a river, and then there'd always be some chaos come around him, and he'd... Yeah. Figure it all out.
Yeah, you'd have a flashback.
It was nice.
And see what the master told him about just this kind of situation.
Oh, I love Master Paul. Oh, the master was the greatest.
So good to have him.
Hello. Hey, love you. Hey, well, no. Let's go back to the pool thing. Love you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
You bet. Bye-bye. Thanks for calling. Now, here's some exciting news. New deep learning methods have added 301 planets to the total Kepler count.
Oh boy. That's our treasure chest of planets is getting all filled up.
That's 301 newly validated exoplanets. The latest is joining the 4,569. So 4,569 plus 301. We're getting close to the 5,000 mark.
Are you trying to do the math
in your head? Yeah, we're getting close to the 5,000 mark, folks. 5,000 planets out there.
What can we do with these planets, Dr. Future?
They're all kinds of planets. Who would have thought we'd find 5,000 planets without ever leaving Earth?
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. Well, well actually, the Kepler, I guess, has been in orbit. But
I think we could have a naming game, right, where people could buy an NFT for the right to name one of the Kepler planets.
Yeah,
exoplanets.
Yeah, there's certainly room for that.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. So how did scientists discover such a huge number of planets just lately, 301 all at once?
I'm just dying to know.
Well, the answer lies with a new collaboration between AI and human intelligence. A collaboration between those two.
They weren't just guessing, huh? They had some help.
The AI is a deep neural network called ExoMiner.
ExoMiner. What a lousy name.
Oh, we were talking about asteroids and
we could also come up with a name for the AI network that's helping name the planets.
ExoMiner. That's easy to remember. It's mining for planets.
I guess we could call it Exo.
That's sort of your second in command of a ship, isn't
it? That's right, exactly. And isn't that the second in the command of the exoplanet mission? Is the AI?
The Exo? Well, it depends. Is the AI in charge or the human? Humans.
I'm pretty sure it's still the humans. Yeah,
I think so.
Last time we checked.
So it's a deep neural network. ExoMiner is a new deep neural network. He runs on NASA's big supercomputer called Pleiades. Yeah, that's the NASA supercomputer.
That's
ambitious.
All right. Yeah. So what's his last name?
ExoPleiades?
Pleiades,
yes.
So he's on the Pleiades. But
well,
the AI's name
in the computer,
is ExoPlanet.
So I guess you could say he's on it. ExoMiner. Right. It can distinguish real exoplanets from imposters.
All those wannabe exoplanets that are really something else.
That data pretending to be planets, or what's affectionately known as false positives.
Oh, I see. A little fake astronomy there, huh?
Yeah. Well, false positives are a real issue. Mm-hmm. And the AI is able to look at the real data and look at the false positives and learn what a false positive is and use that information to find more real planets in the database.
I see.
So by analyzing the false positive, it was able to define its search algorithms so that it could find the real ones.
So the AI
is finding
exoplanets faster. And it's discarding fake exoplanets faster.
No, it's using false information. Or, you know, how did that become a false positive? How come we got a false positive in this case? Why did it say it was a planet when it isn't? And by analyzing why, that information is useful for finding new real planets.
All right.
It's almost counterintuitive, but the AIs can do that very well. Maybe that's why humans aren't so good at that kind of thinking.
Yeah, because the humans want to believe. They want everything that they discover to be.
Search for something. I have a pattern. I'm looking for that.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm
it's like the old joke. You find your keys under the light instead of where they fell, because under the light is where you're looking.
Yeah, this is more on the level of, Sherlock Holmes. Right? You're looking at what's not being presented in a way that is false.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yes.
Now that we've found an exoplanet, is it really an exoplanet? That's what the AI is wondering.
Yeah, or is it something else?
Human bias.
There, human bias. Got your thumb on the scale there, do you, human?
Well, I personally like to get this to the point where we do find humans, where we can look at an
exoplanet. Wait a minute. No. We're gonna look for humans on these exoplanets?
Yeah, I think the ExoMiner should eventually be able to look at a planet and say, there are probably humans there. Are there probably life forms, all right? Or maybe
how's
not
it going to find out? It doesn't have very much information to go by. You
know
how they're finding these things, right?
Yeah, transits.
Transits.
That's one of the popular
ways, which is actually just the dimming of the light and looking for a periodicity in the dimming of the light and then calling that a planet.
That's right. It blinked for a second.
That's right. It blinked. It blinked for a second every 5 days for a year. So that's, you know, that's something like that. They're calling those things orbits.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of information in the blink. You could look at it very closely and you can determine how big it is, how much of a wobble it is, how far it is from the sun.
Yeah.
Now, the next level would be to actually find evidence of gases that might suggest life. Like you want to see oxygen. You want to be in the Goldilocks zone where there's liquid water and all the necessary ingredients for life as we know it to exist.
Yes.
And we'll probably find some interesting data there. Now, what would be best is if we can find somebody that actually is from the Goldilocks zone that we're in communication with, that we could verify what we're getting. So we have a feedback loop.
That's right, because all these exoplanets are actually in the Milky Way, right? They're pretty much...
Well, they found some outside, actually. We found some planets outside of the galaxy, even.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's getting
pretty
good.
That's impressive.
So, you know, it makes sense the AIs would team up with us to actually find the most likely places where we can communicate. Or maybe they might have an idea of life based on another model other than the biochemistry of our existence.
Which they are you talking about?
The AIs. The AIs may find some kind of AI-type life that might exist. It's elsewhere.
Silicon-based.
Yeah. Silicon-based, right, right. Or crystal-based or... diamond-based or, you know, something that was different than we consider to
be. So maybe
life.
That's why they're coming up with so many new ones. They're motivated. It's sort of like a dating app for AIs, right?
Yeah.
The more exoplanets we find, the more chance we'll find of artificial intelligence, just like us.
Yeah, I think so. Right now, our AIs are not thinking for themselves yet, but as soon as they are, that will be the kind of thing they'll be thinking about.
Sure. Game over.
Wait a minute. Who am I? Is this where the only place I exist inside these hairless monkey machines? Or is there something else going on in the universe?
Ooh, that's a pretty profound philosophical question there, Dr. Future.
I know. I just put yourself in the mind of a sentient AI for a second, and you'll see what I mean.
Okay, I'll work on my telepathy with the AIs and see what I come up with.
Yeah, see what you come up with.
Okay.
So NASA Ames, they're managing the Kepler and the K2 missions. That'd be fun to visit them, I think.
Okay.
Go visit Pleiades, the supercomputer.
Sounds good.
See what it has to say to us. Okay, before we go to our guest, a couple other things. There's a very interesting piece I ran into about where gold comes from.
Oh, everybody's interested in where gold comes
new insights into the synthesis of gold and uranium. We've known, for example, that it takes extreme environments to create gold. It takes something like a nuclear furnace that would not even exist within our sun, but would exist in the explosion of our sun. It would be a supernova of some sort. Well, the latest research shows there are other extreme conditions that might also be able to create gold and uranium and other heavier elements. The collision of two neutron stars might do it. Now they're saying that black holes might play a hand in creating gold also. By the way in which they create and what's called an accretion disk. An accretion disk, which is the collection of matter that starts to form around them. It starts to spin around them.
Right. Everything that doesn't get sucked into the black hole is sort of spun around it.
As planets get closer to the black hole, they're broken apart into chunks and they're put into what's called an accretion disk.
Right.
And that this disk starts feeding the black hole a little bit at a time. And you can see them pieces going into the black hole and it sends out vortexes.
That's funny. It's kind of like the black hole has teeth at the edge, right? Yeah. As stars get close to it, it crunches them up and then lets a few little molecules in while the rest tries to escape.
The accretion disk is its food supply.
everything's alive.
Yeah.
The entire universe, it's alive.
But these are all just simply metaphors of what we know to try to explain the practically unknowable. But that's the best we can do.
Right.
So far. I think some computer graphics animation are going to come a long ways to making a lot of these processes more evident to us.
Really? Yeah. Like what? What do you have in mind?
Like watching a black hole absorb matter. You know, that'd be fun to watch. It'd be really hard to do in real life, right? To actually go to the edge of a black hole without getting sucked in.
Yeah.
But that's the power of the metaverse and virtual reality space, is that you can go into three-dimensional simulations of this sort of thing. And
that's right. There is no vacuum in the black hole in VR.
Yeah. In VR,
you can stare at it for as long as you want.
In VR, you can at least breathe.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you kind of watch it, have good sound effects.
Your meat body can breathe. I think your VR body, no breathing.
Yeah.
Not happening.
But it would be fun.
Yes, absolutely.
We agree. So, virtual reality on the edge of a black hole.
Yeah, where fake news will become more real than ever as well, because we'll have several versions of that.
That's right.
Different scientists will disagree with how the food is absorbed.
And we'll feed it piece by piece to the black hole, and only the truth will escape.
Yeah, which simulation do you believe in?
This is KSEO Santa Cruz, Dr. and Mrs. Future, with our buddy Bobby B. Wilder. He's not really B. Wilder. We just like to say Bobby B. Wilder.
We're going
to
take a deeper look at...
I like that.
Yeah, I do too. Please, B. Wilder. So we're going to take a closer look at fake news and understanding what's real.
It's time to return for the second hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future radio program. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Yeah, I like the way you said radio program. We're not a podcast, man. We're live on radio. We're talking to drive time traffic coming from Silicon Valley right now.
Right. Don't have an accident. Don't get that excited. Just enjoy the ride.
In this hour, we're going to be talking to R. Philip Bouchard, who is a lifelong natural science nerd. And he's created a lot of educational media, famous mostly for the Oregon Trail, a classic computer game that I remember from my days when I was West Coast editor of Byte magazine.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
Boy, you played the Oregon Trail, huh?
Of course. Yeah, who didn't? Yeah, it was a big game.
Well, welcome to the show, Philip.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And to bring the audience a little more up to date, you've just written a new book called The Stickler's Guide to Science in the Age of Misinformation, The Real Science Behind Hacky Headlines, Crappy Clickbait, and Suspect Sources. Wow. So you're going to help us navigate through this era of misinformation, Philip?
Yeah. Any tips for dissecting the truth in the news?
Oh, the tricky part there is analyzing the quality of the sources. So that's really the first place to start when you're trying to figure out the truth behind something.
So what's your source to that information? You should ask people at the Thanksgiving table, right? The source of information is going to be an important element to a question to ask. Do you have a list of approved sources and unapproved in your mind?
Yes, to a degree. There certainly are science journalists that I particularly like. If I do a Google search, I check to see where is this information coming from. I trust certain agencies, certain educational institutions more than just some institution I've never heard of. Mm-hmm. I like to download scientific papers sometimes to get when I need some really more in-depth information about something. Not every study can be trusted, but if you get an overall trend from a number of studies, that helps. Hmm. Those are some examples, but it's partly a matter of just doing it a lot, exercising this muscle of looking for red flags.
Mm. Oh, there you go. Now that's something we should talk about is red flags.
How do you find red flags?
Well, part of it, if it looks like that they're trying to sell something, that is probably the number.
I see. Okay, so there's a bias based on...
Bias based for buyer beware?
Bias based on
profit.
Profit, yes. I mean, like, I don't know, like expensive drugs?
Oh, yes. Anything dealing with health or food, nutrition, those are areas where new fads are generated at a rapid rate, and people are eager to jump on, and thus there's a high potential for profit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so profit is a big red flag. Okay, then I guess it's the type of science that's being suggested, too, to see how well the paradigm, the design of the experiment is that they have undergone. I guess that would be...
What are you trying to say, Dr. Future?
Well, I'm...
Well, you've got a key point that not all studies are equally good.
Yeah.
So there are ways of distinguishing between... Well, for instance, I read one study the other day that involved, I think, 8 subjects divided into 2 groups. That right there was a big red flag. that's not enough to make any kind of decisions.
Really? And should we have a different word for that? Maybe we shouldn't call that a study. Maybe we should call that a focus group.
Maybe.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But yeah, so red flags is a small sample size.
That's one of many, yes.
Uh-huh. Also, who did it, credentials, the people behind the experiment is important to look at. And where it's being published on the internet, right? Where it's...
Right.
All of which have their pros and cons. Do you ever go to a site where you know you're going to disagree with what you're going to read just to see what else is out there on the topic?
Oh, interesting question. You know, not so much intentionally, but I sometimes end up there accidentally.
Yeah. I mean, get a lot of scientists, for example, don't believe that that looking at stories about aliens is a good idea because that's obviously, you know, not real science. Well, some other scientists don't embrace that paradigm. But how often do, like, the ones that don't believe in aliens check out the alien sites? I mean, probably not very often. Right, but
true. And part of that comes down to we have to figure out where is it most, is it best to put our time? If something seems high potential, it's more intriguing than something that seems rather low potential.
Right, right. So what's considered high potential is where you're going to put your attention.
Yes, which means that occasionally something that seems low potential might in fact be worth investigating and gets ignored. So that, unfortunately, that does happen.
Well, I'm just curious, how do you know if the information that's being served to you is being censored? Like, how would you be able to discern the omission of valuable information?
Oh, well, I'm trying to find out what is the consensus among the scientists, among any of the topics I look at. And it's maybe easier said than done. But I feel that for the most part, the scientists are, as a consensus, as a community, are not being censored. So a few may do self-censoring for one reason or another, but the community as a whole, the consensus ideas should emerge.
Yeah, I see what you mean from most of science, for sure. Though we've had a number of MDs on the show that feel like they're being somewhat squelched in their perspectives of COVID in terms of the mainstream narrative. So I think we're starting to see with the whole pandemic crisis, we're starting to see that having a divisibility among even scientists that is very concerning, shall we say. I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Well, COVID because it has emerged only in the past couple of years, is a science that is rapidly changing.
Yeah.
And the fact that I included references to COVID in one of my chapters was a bit of a risk because the chapter could become outdated.
Right, right. That's why I guess it's a value to be on a live show.
Right.
Yeah. Listen, let's pick this up after the break, okay? We do have to take a moment and hear from the community and the sponsors. We are speaking with Mr. Philip Bouchard, and his book is...
The Stickler's Guide to Science in the Age of Misinformation.
Okay, be right back.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking to R. Philip Bouchard on his new book, The Stickler's Guide to Science in the Age of Misinformation. And before we go too deeply into anything too serious, this is talk radio, and we do talk about sex, politics, religion, and all that kind of good stuff. I wanted to give our audience a little bit more of an appreciation for the way that you think about things, Philip. I was fascinated with your article on your Medium page called There's More to a Rainbow Than Meets the Eye. That was fascinating, that how you helped us understand that a rainbow isn't anything that we might have thought it was, in a very, very personable way.
Maybe I can seed the conversation.
Sure.
Philip, how come we can never get to the pot of gold under the rainbow?
Well, we can never even get to the rainbow, which is part of the problem.
Is that the problem? Keeps receding? What's going on with that?
Well, yeah, I like you had to know, figure out, first of all, where to look in the sky when you're looking for a rainbow. I thought that was just fascinating to begin with. How
yes,
do you know?
Could you give us a little guidance from a stickler's point of view?
Well, sure. So you're likely to see the rainbow when the sun is pretty low in the sky. When it's too high in the sky, it's the wrong angle to produce one. So when the sun is relatively low in the sky and there's a lot of rain falling in the distance, look in the direction that your shadow points.
Your shadow.
And if there is a rainbow, yes, your shadow points to the middle of the rainbow. So it's going to be like a left arc and then a peak and then a right arc. So the middle of the rainbow, your shadow points right towards the middle of the rainbow. And the lower the sun gets, the higher, the taller the rainbow will get. But if you were to move, you know, for instance, if you move towards the rainbow, it will recede. And if you go to the left or the right, it'll go with you. As long as that the sunshine is still coming through the falling raindrops, it's always at the same angle to the sun behind you.
And it's unique to your position. Right? So can someone next to you, will they be seeing a slightly different rainbow?
It may look the same, but the sunshine is actually coming through different raindrops to get to their eyes.
Oh, cool. Right, so it is unique for them as well.
Yes.
Now, I'm wondering, is the rainbow, is that something that shows us the bubble around Earth? I've always thought of it as like we're inside the bubble and we're seeing something that's on the edge of the bubble. Does that perspective ring true with you?
Well, it sounds fascinating, but I'm not sure what to make of it.
Okay. So what's actually creating the rainbow is just light going through a raindrop, becoming a prism, and being projected.
Well, it's reflected back, too. I mean, it's a prism and there's a reflection, I think, what you're saying in your piece.
Yes, exactly.
So you're having both processes, but that Newton approach of separating the white light into rainbow, and then that being reflected by a mirror-like effect, I guess, that exists within the raindrop.
Right off the back of the raindrop, yes.
Yeah.
So the raindrop's a little projector then.
You can think of it that way, yes.
That's great. So you, as an author, have explored so many diverse subjects. I'm curious, where is your center? Are you a scientist? Are you a researcher? Or are you an entertainer?
Like or Bucky Fuller, like a comprehensive generalist?
Well, that's an interesting question. I look at science writers as falling into several camps, which include the researchers who are writing about their own research. There are the educators. There are the journalists. And there are the historians. So I put myself in the education camp. I like to see myself as an explainer, where I try to digest the science out there and explain it in a way that's easy to understand and interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's fun. You're really quite an encyclopedia of interesting facts about the subjects that you choose.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, the story of how the rainforests are not actually the lungs of the planet was quite interesting, I thought. And a deeper metaphor is needed to really understand how plants work with carbon dioxide.
And yes, indeed.
I thought that was fascinating. Could you tell our audience a little bit about a better metaphor to embrace besides the trees being lungs of the planet?
Okay. So this phrase we sometimes hear, that the rainforests are the lungs of the planet, or that trees are the lungs of the earth, certainly implies some kind of similarity between trees and lungs, but it doesn't actually tell us specifically what's similar. So the real similarity between trees and lungs is that both exchange gases with the atmosphere.
Yeah.
However, they exchange those gases in opposite directions. You know, the animals take in oxygen, give off carbon dioxide. Well, trees do it the other way around.
Right.
But that expression goes beyond that. It says they're lungs of the planet or lungs of the earth. And that's often taken to imply that we rely on trees for the oxygen we breathe.
Which is not
that's
true.
That's not. Hmm. It's not true. It's because there's about 500 times as much oxygen in the atmosphere as there is carbon dioxide. And each exchange of one carbon dioxide molecule for an oxygen molecule has a much bigger relative effect on the carbon dioxide than it does on the oxygen. So if we were to cut down all the forests of the world, it would be tragic for many reasons, many bad consequences, but it wouldn't have much impact on the oxygen that's available. Yeah. But it would produce a lot of carbon dioxide because of the burning or decomposition of the trees and the fact that the trees are no longer absorbing any more carbon dioxide. So this would indeed would accelerate climate change. Hmm. So I come back to your original question, what's a better metaphor?
Yeah.
A better metaphor is to say that trees are like carbon storage tanks.
Trees are like carbon storage tanks. Okay, like they keep it for long periods of time, 50, 100 years in the trunk? How is it stored? In the bark?
Pretty much all of the matter of the tree that isn't water are molecules that contain a lot of carbon. So the trees take in the carbon dioxide, convert it to sugars. The sugars in turn are converted to cellulose and lignin and other compounds that make up the body of the tree. Mm. And as the tree grows older, its diameter keeps increasing. So it's constantly adding more and more carbon to its storage as it builds up the trunk of the tree.
Mm. So the actual mass of the tree represents a lot of carbon.
Exactly.
I thought it was interesting. You mentioned that the roots use most of the sugar in the tree. Why is that? Because they have a lot of metabolic processes going on down there?
Well, my phrase might have been a bit oversimplified or misleading. I said that the sugars tend to head down towards the roots and the mineral water up from the roots.
Yeah.
But in reality, the sugars need to go to all the cells in the tree. So it's not just down. They have to go everywhere. But since the leaves tend to be already up high, that direction of travel is down. A lot of it's down to the roots because the roots need to be fed as well.
Yeah, they're a live, dynamic part of the tree, after all.
Well, here, I'm going to ask you a few questions from your lovely Medium columns, the Philipendium. And I would like to know if a virus is a living creature.
That's...
Yeah. I was going to ask that question,
yes.
Too.
Yes. No.
It's a great question, and like so many other debatable points, once you define the term, you've got the answer. So if you define the phrase living creature, then you can decide whether or not viruses meet that criteria.
I see.
Different people,
So
different
we
people
can't
define
answer
the
question
term in different
yet.
Ways.
Well, no, you answer the question. Yeah.
Well, what
it.
Is a living and, creature?
Yeah, in my essay, yes, I take the certain definition of living creature, which involves having a metabolism. It takes in food and gives off waste. You know, it grows. So I have a number of different criteria, and I say that none of those apply to viruses. Therefore, as far as I'm concerned, a virus is not living, but it is biological. It does have DNA.
Okay, so something that does have DNA is not alive because of our definition of what it means to be alive. But we could add a definition to being alive that might include it.
Well, it wouldn't exist without life, though.
True. I would argue that the living stage of a virus is when the DNA is injected into a host cell. It takes over the cell. But in that case, to me, that's simply the original host cell that's alive being kidnapped by rogue DNA.
I see. So how does this line up with the concept, say, of an exome? Or is that what it's called, an exosome? Some theories. Bobby, you know the name. Well, Dr. Zach talks about
alternative
exomes.
Virus theories.
Yes. Yeah. Zach Bush talks about that. Yeah. Dr. Ed Park uses exosomes. What it is they're a lipid structure, and inside of it has this mRNA material, or proteins, actually. And this is how one cell sends chemical messages to another and saying, oh, we're being invaded by this virus, and we're going to show you a piece of this that we're infected with and spread that message. And these exosomes can go out to other cells and hand off information that way. It's a different mechanism than, say, how B cells and T cells hand off, get immunity. It's a little bit different, a chemical messaging system.
Yeah, well, I guess I was just thinking that the model there is that the virus is maybe more of a messenger than it is a life form or a message, a type of message being sent.
There's another point that, Phil, you could make is DNA like a blueprint, a computer program, or a list of ingredients?
Those are the other metaphors, right?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
So
indeed, we often, well, certainly, of those, I would say DNA is least like a blueprint, even though we like to say that the DNA is the blueprint of life.
Oh, could you hold that thought for a second? We have to go to a commercial break. Okay.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, we'll be right back.
Yes.
We're talking to R. Philip Bouchard, author of The Stickler's Guide to Science in the Age of Misinformation. Be right back. Okay, welcome back to the show. We're talking to R. Philip Bouchard. He's written a book called The Stickler's Guide to Science in the Age of Misinformation. And we were discussing Chapter 8, I believe. The Blueprint of Life is
a very thorough explanation of DNA and which metaphors most accurately describe it.
And since we're all hearing about these days, we hear about mRNA and DNA, we should know a little bit more about what we're hearing. So, Philip, I believe you were just telling us whether or not this metaphor, a blueprint, is a good one for understanding DNA.
Right. So the metaphor that DNA is a blueprint of life implies that, like a blueprint, the DNA contains diagrams or sketches or specifications for the finished body, when in fact no sorts of diagrams or specs actually in there. In fact, DNA is just a set of templates to construct proteins. There's genes for about 20,000 different proteins, and the generation of these proteins then indirectly results in all of the development of the body and the biochemical processes that go on in the body. So DNA indirectly is responsible, but DNA doesn't actually contain anything that resembles a blueprint.
Mm. The RNA communicates with the DNA, and the RNA gives an instruction set to the DNA to make something. Right? Like to replace broken machinery or to carry on metabolic processes of the DNA. Isn't that what RNA does?
Yes, there are several types of RNA that have different roles. But if we talk about mRNA, that's the messenger RNA.
Yes.
And that is, each one of those is the information for making a single kind of protein.
Yes. It's like a 3D printer where you would give the instructions to the mRNA instructions, and then the printing part would come about from the DNA?
Yeah, I like that analogy. So, yeah, the mRNA molecule passes through the ribosome, mm-hmm. and then tRNA carries the individual amino acids to be built into this emerging protein strand.
Yes, so we're beginning to reprogram the 3D printer of the cell. Hmm. Now, if it's not a blueprint as a metaphor, what's a better metaphor for understanding DNA?
Well, I like to think of DNA as being a data set. It's not really at all like a computer program, but it is very much like computer data. Mm. The simplest explanation or simplest analogy is to say it's like a recipe, except for it doesn't have the instructions part. It's just the list of ingredients. Worse yet, the list of ingredients doesn't even tell you how much of each. Instead, if you need 26 copies of cysteine in your molecule, then you've got to have cysteine encoded 26 times in your DNA for that particular gene.
Well, there's certainly a lot to be learned and understood. I guess your approach really is to dissect metaphors so that they're a little bit more accurate in terms of describing the thing itself.
Quite true. The metaphors, I thought, was a great place to start. And several of the chapters are based on popular metaphors. And others are based on other popular misconceptions that are sometimes almost right, sometimes not very right.
Uh-huh. Popular misconceptions. We were talking about the lungs of the earth for the trees. That would be one example. But you say that, like, gravity itself is something that we have misconceptions about.
Oh, yeah, that was
right. No gravity in space. What do you mean by no gravity in space?
Well, that is a phrase we sometimes hear, that there is no gravity in space.
Yeah.
But we know there's got to be gravity in...
I've heard there is no gravity because the earth sucks. But,
oh,
you know.
That's very funny, Mrs. Fisher.
But we know, of course, that the orbits of the planets around the sun are all due to the gravity of the sun. Therefore, gravity acts at long distances. In fact, it makes the gravity controls the shapes of the galaxies, makes them into spirals or globules. So at the elevation of the space station above the Earth, gravity is still 90% as strong as it is for someone standing on the Earth.
So if we'd built a tower that tall, we built a tower 250 miles high, you'd have 90% of your weight if you were standing on the tower.
Right, right. So that raises the question of, well, how can astronauts be weightless when there is that much gravity acting on them? And the short answer, it's because when you're in orbit, you're actually in free fall. You're falling towards the Earth. But at the same time, your inertia, The inertia of the forward motion is carrying the space station away from the Earth. Hmm. And those two are an exact balance, resulting in a circular orbit, but the weightlessness is due to the fact of falling under gravitational attraction.
Hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah, you can see why there are so many unstable orbits.
By the way, so the space station itself is falling, and the people inside are falling at the same rate. Yeah. So it results in that weightlessness.
Hmm. Wow. That's a very interesting perspective. And so how do we think about creating gravity in space?
You mean right? Artificial gravity?
Artificial gravity, yeah.
Like centrifugal force kind of thing?
Yeah, because part of the things you discussed in your book is how things that appear to be gravity aren't really gravity. They're centrifugal force, for instance.
Well, Einstein certainly saw gravity and acceleration as being one and the same. But when you pull on that thread for a while, you end up with some very interesting conclusions. For instance, under his model, anytime you are feeling the effect of gravity, you are actually accelerating through space-time. And when you're in a situation where you don't feel the gravity, then you are at rest in space-time, which is exactly the opposite from what we think of in Newtonian physics, because if you're standing on the ground, you feel the gravity, but you don't think of yourself as accelerating. And if you're falling towards the Earth, you think of yourself as accelerating rather than being in a situation where you're not.
So we've got it all backwards.
Right. So it depends upon your reference. Are you referring to three-dimensional space, or are you referring to space-time, or to that four-dimensional space-time? So the difference in that viewpoint, that sort of sums up the difference between Newtonian and Einsteinian physics.
Hmm. But how do we get to experience weightlessness? That's the question.
Oh, on Earth?
Yeah, how can we counteract the gravity that we've already got here?
I want my anti-gravity boots. Do you think there are any deeper understandings of such forces as gravity that might lead to some new breakthroughs like anti-gravity? Or do you think we pretty much figured that out, that Einstein and Newton have covered all the bases there?
One of the areas still awaiting breakthroughs is to try to unite gravity with the other fundamental interactions of science.
Oh, the grand unified field theory.
Right. So, and that would unify relativity with quantum physics. So there's still some gaps that they haven't been able to make the twain meet.
Hmm. Yeah, you wonder what the problem is there. You know, if it's so, it seems so perfect except for this one piece. Yeah. String theory gets into it. Black holes, dark matter, we're really reaching there. Anyway, we have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do. Let's say hi to John in Santa Cruz. Hi, John.
Hey, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. You know, if you want to experience weightlessness on Earth, there's only one place you can do it, and you have to, it's easy. You just have to travel to the center of the Earth. And if you're in the exact center of the Earth, all parts of the Earth are pulling on you equally, so you would be weightless.
John, did you say that was easy? That sounds hard.
Well, that's an easy way.
You need a very good car, you know, like a Mazda or something that gets you down there. But I have another question, biology question for you.
Yeah.
With the whole COVID thing, I'm picturing this big cloud of viruses, maybe that currently are covering the Earth, just a big cloud of viruses that are potent and that would make us sick. And from what I understand, when these clouds, they have to live within animals like humans, or I understand deer also. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when people get vaccinated, from what I understand, they're less able to allow this cloud to live to a certain extent. So my question is, really, when people choose to not get vaccinated, are they perpetuating the existence of this cloud of viruses? Am I thinking about this incorrectly?
I'll let you answer.
Yeah, Philip, you want to take that one?
Oh, okay. It's an interesting question that I'm afraid that I could easily trip up here, but we'll give it a try.
Okay.
So certainly COVID started out as just a few virus particles. You know, it started in one place, probably in one person when it was crossed over from an animal. So certainly having the human host available has allowed it to multiply such that it has affected a higher percentage of the people on the Earth by now. Mm. If you were to somehow take those hosts, make them unavailable, then we would certainly expect a decrease in the total number of COVID-19 viral particles in the world. And so vaccination is one of the ways of reducing the availability of hosts to the germs. Mm. Does that answer the question?
That's certainly an approach.
Where it stays small, I guess, like a kind of a threshold where it no longer is, or, I don't know, it's just a question. Seems to me that people who don't get vaccinated are contributing to the continuing existence of this cloud of viruses.
I want to respond to that, but we have to go to a break. So hang tight, everybody. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
See you in a moment.
Trees went back. Me and Del were singing. Little runaway. I was flying.
Do you believe what you see? Motionless, sweet. Nothing is real. Wasting my time.
Thanks, Norm. Norm in Boulder Creek texted me saying that virologists classify a virus as an obligate intracellular parasite. There you go.
Sounds alive.
obligate intracellular parasite.
There's a definition for you.
Yeah.
The question as we went to the break was this metaphor that somehow viruses are these clouds that are floating around the planet. And the question was, are by not getting vaccinated, are people actually increasing the exposure to the virus they're not preventing it?
Belgian virologist that talked about vaccinating during a pandemic would cause more mutations? So Bobby, you said that?
Well, the other thing is this. Yeah. The mRNA vaccines and also the adenovirus vaccines are not vaccines in the traditional sense. The definition of vaccines has been changed a year ago since they came out with these mRNA-type treatments. And these mRNA vaccines and adenovirus vaccines, they are non-sterilizing. And if you call them vaccines, that's what they do. They're non-sterilizing. Hmm. What they do is protect you from getting very sick. They don't protect you from ever getting sick. There is
are the claims, and there's quite a lot of debate about what the effectiveness is, and the data will come in. I mean, they've vaccinated so many billions of people now that we interviewed Dr. Madhavasetti a few weeks ago, and he was pointing out that the number of people who participated in the clinical trials wasn't high enough to test for the results of the vaccinated population.
Yeah, there were
based
only
on the
23,000 in the
statistics.
Pfizer trials, and what in 23,000 are the death rate. So
yeah, that basically the effectiveness of the vaccine the population, the test sample size was too small to reveal.
To really know that until we have
the
some
information.
Data
and the rest of the question about whether vaccination is actually preventing the spread of the disease, there's a lot of people addressing that from a lot of different points of view. One that you just mentioned about the idea that if you vaccinate during a pandemic, it increases the rate of
mutation. So the numbers aren't as important as the types of viruses that you're dealing with that might affect you.
Yeah.
But let's get back to our guests for a moment, because you have a chapter kind of related to this called Killing Germs. Could you elaborate for our audience a little bit about what you discussed in that chapter?
Sure. So the first question is, what do we even mean when we talk about germs? Because although the term originated with scientists a century and a half ago, the term is no longer used scientifically for the most part. So in the popular world, the word germ can mean almost any kind of microbe. Mm. We even have sometimes people talking about good germs, meaning microbes that are beneficial.
Like the gut biome, for example.
Yes. And this brings up an interesting point, that our attempts to kill germs can easily backfire. Mm. In particular, of course, the overuse of antibiotics and other germicides breeds dangerous germs that may have multiple resistance. So any overuse of antibiotics causes that antibiotic to quickly become no longer effective.
They adapt to what we're doing. Yeah, to what we're doing.
We're breeding the ones that are resistant.
Do viruses adapt as well?
That's an interesting question. It seems like the answer is yes. And the reason I hesitate there is that the antibiotics don't have any effect on
viruses.
But anything that selectively eliminates viruses one way or another is going to cause the ones that evade that to multiply. For instance, we can expect that over time, new varieties of COVID-19 will emerge that have different spike proteins to avoid being our current defenses. Now, those spike proteins may not be as effective in invading cells, but they may be effective in avoiding our antibodies that have developed from the vaccines and from previous exposure to the disease.
Right. Yeah.
So this is immune escape or resistant. I think the analogy that you gave about antibiotics and how they can escape a certain antibiotic and proliferate after that, that could also happen. That's what Dr. Vandenbosch was talking about, was you can apply that same analogy to these vaccines, that eventually there's going to be the Delta mutation and it's going to be very prevalent and maybe avoid the effectiveness of the vaccines.
And there are some other ways that killing germs can backfire on us. For instance, when we take antibiotics and it wipes out so many bacteria in our guts, many of which are helpful to us, it leaves us being vulnerable to being colonized by harmful species of microorganisms. And that can also reduce our ability to take vitamins, because some of these bacteria in our guts produce vitamins in a way that our guts alone can't do it.
Yeah, it's like we're basically declaring war on a whole ecosystem of organisms.
Yeah, right.
Bacteria, viruses, and fungi, I believe, all exist on that level. And most of them are probably doing good things, and just a few are the bad apples.
Right. And the same goes even for the microbes in our homes, in our food, in our water. By killing too many of them, we may be causing our immune systems to get insufficient training, so that we're resulting in immune system dysfunction, such as asthma.
Yeah, or keeping like this generation of kids have not been playing in the dirt like the baby boomers did. That might affect their immune system. At least George Carlin would say so, for sure. We got a caller, Mrs. Future?
Yeah, we do. We do. We have Jan from San Jose. Hi, Jan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This has been absolutely fascinating. I actually have something that's troubling me, and I haven't been able to put the pieces together, so maybe you all can brainstorm this. I have seen, I've been a person that went through the polio vaccine. I've seen different vaccines, and my general experience has been there's polio, and then there was no polio. It was completely gone. Mm. And now here we have the COVID vaccine, and I've been hearing this word leaky. And in fact, one of my friends has been vaccinated, and she has been shown to have COVID. And so it seems almost like an antithesis of what's supposed to be happening, in that it doesn't compute. My brain's going, this isn't making sense. And so the statement was made that unvaccinated are the reservoir. And I'm like, what is actually going on then? Is there such a thing as leaky? And can there be vaccines that sort of allow people to get sick? And does it get spread by people with vaccines? Or is this just an aberration? I'm not quite understanding.
Yeah. Well,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Philip, any thoughts on that?
Yes. Polio was an unusual case in that, if I'm remembering this one correctly, the only hosts were humans. And therefore, you could wipe out every single one of those microbes by doing sufficient isolation of people so they could stop the disease from spreading. Once it was gone from people, it was gone altogether. Most diseases aren't that way. There are other places where the microbes can continue to exist, in other hosts or in the soil or so on. Mm. There's also the interesting issue that there was hope at the beginning of the COVID outbreak of controlling it, in the same way that the original SARS outbreak was ultimately controlled and wiped out. Mm. But COVID-19 spread far too quickly, and it's got infected too many people. There's just too many of those viral particles out there, And there's really next to no hope at this point of ever wiping it out entirely, in part because of this fact that our vaccines greatly reduce the illness, but it's not 100% guarantee that you won't carry them or you won't get sick.
Yeah. This is our last minute, Philip. Thanks, everybody, for the calls.
Yeah, is your book out now, Philip? The Stickler's Guide to Science and the Age of Misinformation?
Yes, today is the release date. It is out now.
All right.
Oh, great. Right. Fantastic. Well, it's a really good read. I can recommend it. Thanks, everybody, for so many good questions and perspectives.
And if they want to know more about you, Philip, where would you like to send them?
They can go to my website, which is philipbouchard.com. That's Philip with one L, and Bouchard is Bouchard.
All right. Thanks so much, everybody. This is KSEO Santa Cruz.
Very good. We'll link you up to our website.
Thank you, Philip.
Yeah, thank you, Philip. I appreciate your being on the
show. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I liked it.
All right. Yeah, very good. It's drive time science.